Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Due to the publicity about sports injuries or the use of IEDs, improvised explosive device, against the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan, there's a growing awareness among Americans about traumatic brain injury, or TBIs. But many may not know that the average TBI doesn't occur on the battlefield or the sports field, but is most likely to be an accident of some sort, a car accident, a fall, or a home or workplace injury. And our understanding of the psychiatric effects of brain injury is even less than our understanding of the prevalence. My guest today is the co-author of a primer for family and close friends of those suffering from TBI, which can range from a concussion up to more severe traumas. The Traumatized Brain, a family guide to understanding mood, memory, and behavior after brain injury, discusses the possible impairments and damages to emotions, physicality, behavior, and cognitive function, and outlines the possible treatments and therapies, and also how those close to the injury should deal with these changes, which may or may not seem readily connected to the injury. My guest today is one of the two co-authors, Dr. Sandeep Vaishnavi, who's a director of the Neuropsychiatric Clinic at Carolina Partners. He's a neuropsychiatrist at the Tisch Brain Tumor Center at the Duke University Medical School. He's also a clinical associate in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Duke Medicine. He and co-author Avani Rao are brain injury specialists, and he joins me today here on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Vaishnavi, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It seems like you and your colleague wrote this book really for the families and the people surrounding a person with TBI. There seems to be no normal in how the brain heals from a traumatic brain injury and what sort of side effects manifest themselves. What was the reason for writing this book?
Well, traumatic brain injury is a huge public health concern, and one of the main reasons for writing this book was that even though that's more well known now that traumatic brain injury is serious, it's still something that can be minimized by a lot of people, inadvertently perhaps. So, for example, you know, we know that we have millions of brain injuries every year in this country, but that's probably an underreport because there are milder brain injuries, concussions that are probably never brought to medical attention, and sometimes, you know, those are things that may need medical attention. So that was one of the reasons was to have people understand that traumatic brain injury is serious and it's something that needs to be treated. And the other main reason was that we focused actually on the mood, behavioral, and cognitive symptoms of traumatic brain injury, which tend to be the long-term consequences of TBI. And those are the very symptoms that kind of get swept under the rug or are not fully appreciated.
Is it because those around them or the person themselves don't recognize those mood and behavioral shifts?
Right. I think that's part of it. A lot of times with brain injury, especially with more severe brain injury, there is a loss of insight. So the person who's suffering from the brain injury doesn't realize that they're having changes in their mood and behavior and focus and so forth. And the other aspect is that in some cases, people may not tie these together. They may not tie the brain injury, the traumatic brain injury, with these kinds of symptoms because, you know, we all have the sense that we can control our moods or we can control our behavior. And when things go awry like this, when there's a brain injury, we may continue with that assumption. Well, that's just me. It's not really the brain injury. And also, family members or loved ones may not understand or realize that with damage to the brain, to certain circuits of the brain, you can have these mood changes and behavioral changes and memory and attention changes. And that's something that we wanted to convey in this book so that people understand that, you know, this is directly related to damage to the brain.
Now, you mentioned several million TBIs each year, and in the book you referred to it as a silent epidemic. How prevalent is the underreporting of TBIs? Do we have any idea of how many cases are not being reported?
Well, it's probably quite significant. So the estimation is 1.5 to 2 million cases of traumatic brain injury occur in the United States every year. Now, most likely we're talking about more moderate to severe brain injuries. When we're dealing with concussions or mild traumatic brain injuries, that's probably many manifold higher. I mean, it's probably an order of magnitude higher. And so I don't know for sure exactly how much that is. I mean, it's an underreport, so we don't really truly know. But we are beginning to think more and more that maybe repetitive mild traumatic brain injuries or concussions may actually have these kind of mood, behavioral, and cognitive consequences in the long run. And I think there's more realization of that, especially with more focus being put on things like the NFL and NFL players, and there's been a lot of media coverage about that. But it's not just at that level. It could be at any level, really, in terms of children, adolescents, young people, anyone who plays sports. If you have multiple concussions, there is a risk that there might be long-term consequences. And I think those symptoms are now being appreciated more just now. So I think it'll be time before we'll have a better sense of actually how many brain injuries there are.
Give us a sense of what the latest research in that suggests about these repeated mild concussions or TBIs, mainly, I guess, from sports injuries. You mentioned football, right, but it could be soccer, it could be basketball, any contact sport.
Yeah, there is this notion of something called chronic traumatic encephalopathy. It's a long term, but in short, it's called CTE. And that's essentially a pathological diagnosis. That's basically on autopsy where pathologists open up the brain and they see changes in the brain that show neurodegeneration. In other words, it looks in some ways like Alzheimer's disease, and also in some ways there are some Parkinsonian symptoms or Parkinson's disease symptoms. So there is this is a relatively new concept that the repetitive mild brain injuries or concussions can actually lead to these really significant changes in the brain on pathology. Now, there's an older literature on that with boxing. So there is this other term that people have used called dementia pugilistica, which
right,
another big term. But basically, it's related to multiple hits to the head in boxing. And we do know that there have been boxers and professional and unprofessional otherwise also who have suffered multiple brain hits and have developed dementia-type symptoms, cognitive symptoms. But the concept now is that, well, you know, perhaps this is more prevalent than we had thought before. Now, it's still a controversial issue because the studies that have been done mostly have been with professional sports players, NFL in particular. You know, and if you look at just those studies, there is a very high prevalence of this kind of consequence of repetitive mild concussions or mild brain injuries. But we're not sure if that's really applicable to the rest of the population because you have to understand that these studies that I'm referring to, these were football players whose families felt that there was something off or something wrong, and they asked for autopsy, and so and then they were enrolled in these various studies. So it's kind of a selection bias. That is that people were self-selected to be in this study. And so that may not be representative of everyone. But nonetheless, I think it's intuitively, I think we now understand that having head injuries, having multiple brain injuries is probably not a good thing. The question is, how bad is it? And in some cases, it can be really bad in terms of long-term consequences.
In case some of these long-term consequences, you mentioned we find this out through pathology studies after the person is deceased. Is there
right,
any good testing while they're still alive to be able to test and see
right,
this function in various CT scans or MRIs of any sort?
Well, there are actually no definitive scans or tests that we have, no definitive tests other than pathology. However, having said that, we do have some imaging technologies that may be more sensitive to picking up some of this damage to the brain. So you mentioned CT scans. With CT scans or CAT scans, generally they're actually going to be normal for concussions, for mild brain injury. Now, with more severe brain injury, yes, we could see damage such as bleeding in the brain. That's really what we're looking for on a CT scan. And MRI has better resolution, so you can see the brain better, and you can see maybe more consequences. But with mild TBI, you're probably going to have a normal MRI as well. Now, there are more sophisticated tests, imaging tests, which are called functional imaging tests, which might pick up more abnormalities, so such as a SPECT scan, S-P-E-C-T, SPECT scan, and functional MRI scans. And there are certain variants of MRIs called diffusion tensor imaging scans. These scans may pick up more cases will actually show the consequences of these concussions or repetitive mild brain injuries. So, you know, we do have that, and we also have neuropsychological testing or neurocognitive testing, which is basically getting running a person through a battery of cognitive tests, and sometimes fairly subtle abnormalities can be picked up from those tests. So that's kind of where we are in terms of state-of-the-art, but none of these are absolutely definitive, not like pathology.
I know certainly one of the things that are happening in athletics today, for example, at the University of Tulsa, they're doing baseline studies when the athletes come into them. And so when they are injured in the course of a game, they have that baseline as they're, hopefully if they're in good condition when they first come to the university, they have this sort of baseline study that they can compare to. So they're doing a whole battery of tests, the cognitive test as well as scans.
Right.
Do you think that's going to be more commonplace in professional and like high-dollar college athletics?
Yes, I think that is where we're heading, actually, with this. I think people are now beginning to take this much more seriously, as we've talked about. And you know, it is a scary thing. I mean, obviously, no one wants to have damage to their brain. And so by doing this kind of baseline testing, I think that's really important. Because otherwise, if you don't have the baseline testing, after, let's say, you do have some number of mild brain injuries, TBIs, well, you know, you're really, when they do the testing, you know, you're looking at essentially how your performance is compared to other people your age. And if it's a subtle deficit that you have, you may actually end up being in the normal range. But what you're really looking for, if you're the player, let's say, what you're really looking for is, well, you know, I feel different. Something is off, and I don't feel like myself. And but that may not be picked up if you're just comparing that, comparing the performance after the injury to just normal, a normal number of, you know, just a kind of a regular gamut of people. So what you really want to do is you want to compare how you were before the injury to how you were after the injury. And that's what a lot of, as you mentioned, lots of colleges are now kind of moving towards, because that will really let us know what is that difference, what happened because of the brain injury. And it's important also for tracking purposes over time. Now, I have to, you know, kind of interject that for most people who have a mild traumatic brain injury, a concussion, they do recover. And, you know, most people within several months, within 3 months, will have recovery. Now, but what we're concerned about is really if you keep having them, the repetitive mild brain injuries. And that's where this whole notion of CTE comes up, is that, well, you know, you're able to recover, but if you keep getting them over time, you may not recover, or at least not recover very well. And by tracking it, by doing these kind of cognitive tests, baseline and post-injury tests, that is one way to really kind of get at this, and other than pathology.
And really, that's that change of the recovery for a mild concussion, that sort of recovery time has changed over the, say, the last generation. I think most people would say a couple of weeks, you're back to normal.
Right.
And in fact, what we're finding now is that you're really not back to normal for months,
right,
at least a couple of months, and maybe even longer.
Right. Yeah, and there is a lot of variability in this. And I think in the past, what happened is that, well, we really didn't take it very seriously. Even the terminology, the language that people would use, you know, I got my bell rung, or
right,
you know, I got knocked out. I mean, even the terminology was very casual. It's like it's no big deal. But, you know, it is a big deal. And whenever you have a brain injury, it is a big deal. And I think as time has gone on, as people have studied this more and more, I think we've used finer instruments to sort of tease apart what's really going on. So yes, you may have lost consciousness for just a few seconds, and you may seem like you're back to normal immediately afterwards. But we do know now that there are changes in the brain that occur. There are actually metabolic changes that occur in the brain with a brain injury, even a mild brain injury. And there are consequences, and it does take time. And in fact, the American Academy of Neurology now recommends that after a concussion, that the player not go back to the game at all, even if they're feeling fine, you know, at least from what they're saying, not go back to the game until they are cleared by a specialist in brain injury. So we're taking it so much more seriously than before, which I think is a good thing. And we are realizing that there are longer-term consequences of even mild brain injuries. So it's not just, you know, you're back on your feet, so you're fine. It's that you can have mood changes. You can have irritability, personality changes, depression. You can have behavioral changes. You can have memory and attention changes. You're not able to focus as well as before. You're not able to process information as quickly as before. And all of these things do take time to recover.
My guest today is Dr. Sandeep Vaishnavi, the director of the Neuropsychiatric Clinic at Carolina Partners. He's also a neuropsychiatrist at the Tisch Brain Tumor Center at Duke University, where he's a clinical associate in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. He's our guest today on studio. He's also co-author of The Traumatized Brain, A Family Guide to Understanding Mood, Memory, and Behavior After Brain Injury. And this gets to this whole idea. We're talking about how we're taking TBIs more serious and concussions. In the past generation or two, in fact, we should remind folks that, you know, most TBIs are not military cases. There are probably quite a few sports cases, but most are from accidents, falling at home, falling off a ladder, in a car accident. You might have had an accident, hit your head. But unless you were seriously unconscious, you might not even see a doctor. So what is your best advice for someone who suffers what seems like a minor head injury? When is it appropriate to see a doctor?
That's a very good question. So it's important to keep in mind that every time you hit your head, it doesn't mean that you necessarily have a traumatic brain injury. The definition of traumatic brain injury, I think, the best definition, is that it's where you're dazed or confused, even if it's momentarily. So that's a very important thing to keep in mind. So if, for example, you just kind of walk into the door and you bumped your head and you're fine, I mean, you don't have any changes, you have no alteration in your awareness, you don't feel confused, you don't feel dazed, you don't feel out of it, well, that's okay. That's not a traumatic brain injury. So for that, you wouldn't have to go to a doctor. What we want to be careful about, though, is that if you do have something which is more than that, if you do have this certainly loss of consciousness or just being dazed or confused for some time, even momentarily, that by definition is a traumatic brain injury. It's a mild traumatic brain injury. A mild traumatic brain injury, by definition almost, for most people, as I said, if you have just one of them, it does recover. It does recover over time. What we want to make sure of, though, is that if there is kind of prolonged problems from that, for example, if you are not quite yourself, you continue to have problems, you should see a doctor for sure. You want to make sure that there's not anything more significant going on. Perhaps it seemed like a mild brain injury, but maybe there were no witnesses and actually turned out to be something more significant, such as causing bleeding in the brain. You know, that, of course, would be something you want to be evaluated for. But it's important to not, I don't want to unnecessarily frighten people. For most mild brain injuries, people do just fine. But again, you have to monitor it really, really carefully. So my personal bias would be to have it seen. I think it's better to have it looked at for a doctor to evaluate you if you have this injury where you're dazed and confused. And that way, at least they can track you over time, perhaps with cognitive type of testing like we talked about, or if needed, a CT scan just to make sure there's no bleeding. That would be my personal bias. I think there are different opinions about it. But I think the basic point is that you want to take it seriously. You don't want to just ignore it.
And going back to what you said earlier, the idea of the euphemism, I just got my bell rung. Mm-hmm. Well, if there's nobody there to witness it, you may not have an idea how long you were dazed.
Right. Absolutely.
That's the other thing I think about TBIs a lot of times is that patients themselves don't have the cognitive ability to understand the depth or seriousness of their impairment, even if it's just for 5 minutes or 10 minutes.
Right. No, absolutely right. It's one of the ironies, and it's your brain. This whole process is actually very recursive. It's almost cyclical because you're asking your brain to make a judgment about your brain, right? So if you're dazed, confused, then you may not remember that actually, or especially if there's no one around you who can tell you exactly what happened. So you may not have a good sense of how long it occurred and so forth. So certainly, I think that's why I would say that it's a good idea to get evaluated, to be seen by your doctor, and at least you will get a sense of where you are right now, and kind of it can be monitored by a professional. I think that's really important because otherwise it's hard to do it to yourself for yourself, because we're talking about the brain, and obviously the brain is critical for everything you do, and you do want to take it seriously.
Well, this gets again to the importance of family and people surrounding the person with a TBI or a concussion. This points to I think the reason you wrote the book. The book starts actually, you're explaining brain function, which is, when you're going to see a doctor, the doctor will tell you what he thinks you need to know, but it may not give you a basic underlying understanding of the condition, because doctors are very busy and, hopefully they're explaining everything properly, but they're also trying to get it done in the most direct, quick fashion as possible. And this is one thing your book does, is it goes through the entire process of the brain, and it also points out the importance of family members and friends observing the person with the injury.
Yeah, family members and friends are critical. Loved ones are critical after a brain injury for multiple reasons. One of them is to be able to really assess it more objectively, like we just talked about. The person with a brain injury may not have the insight and may not realize that they're changing, their head changes. So that's really important that there is someone else who is able to kind of objectively look at it and see how you're doing, number one. Number two is that it is important just in terms of recovery, especially with the more severe brain injuries. Loved ones, just having loved ones around and being able to help you as you go through this process of recovery is critical. And it's a long process sometimes with the more severe brain injuries. And multiple specialists, multiple doctors are involved, and they have their own language and their way of speaking. And so it is important, I think, to understand a little bit about the brain because you can't really truly understand brain injury until you understand how the brain normally functions. So you have to understand brain function to understand brain dysfunction.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that this book points out is there seems to be no normal in how the brain, the side effects and symptoms of brain injuries manifest themselves and how well the brain heals, for that matter. What are the most common symptoms of TBI? You go through them in the book, and they can range from emotional to physical to behavioral to cognitive. And some of them are somewhat surprising. For example, the emotional symptoms you know, could be depression, anxiety. Mania is somewhat surprising, the idea that you become sort of manic in your behavior. That's completely surprising. We think of actually, if anything, a brain injury slowing somebody down in a way.
Right. Well, it really just depends on what part of the brain is affected, and that's really one of the big points in the traumatized brain in this book, is that there are different circuits for different functions for the brain. So we do know that, and we can appreciate that, you know, there's a circuit for motor functions or movements. There's a circuit for sensory processing, so touch and vibration and things like that, pain, etc. But there are also circuits for what I would call higher order functioning, circuits for memory and attention and for emotional regulation and mood and anxiety and things like that. So it depends on exactly what happened in the brain injury and what part of the brains were affected, what circuits were affected. So depending on what circuits are affected, you may end up with things like mania. I mean, that's not terribly common, but it certainly can occur after traumatic brain injury. Depression is common. A person can directly, because of the brain injury, because circuitry that affects mood regulation is awry because of the brain injury, that can directly cause depression. So all of these symptoms can occur just because of the neuroanatomy, essentially. So that's one of the main reasons we wanted to talk about the circuitry and the anatomy of the brain so that people can understand, well, hey, this is why I got damaged to this part of my brain, and now I can see why I have these particular symptoms. And as you mentioned, you know, there are kind of a wide gamut of symptoms after brain injury, and I would kind of categorize them into a number of different things. I mean, one is mood, as we talked about. So under mood, depression can absolutely occur. There is a high rate of depressive symptoms after traumatic brain injury. Depending on the study you look at, anywhere from 40% or perhaps even higher with in terms of depression after brain injury. And, you know, it is important to keep in mind that when we talk about depression, we're not just talking about, well, you know, I'm feeling down because my life has been sort of turned topsy-turvy. And that's legitimate, of course. But some of these depressive symptoms can be because of the circuitry that was damaged because of the injury. So there's that. There's also behavioral changes, such as personality changes. The frontal lobe is really important in terms of personality, and damage to certain parts of the frontal lobe can truly change our personality. They can change how we interact with other people, make us socially coarser than we normally would be, for example. And then there are cognitive changes, which are very common after brain injuries, such as attentional problems, may not be able to focus like before, may not be able to sustain your attention like before, may not be able to remember things like before. And then besides that, there are other general physical symptoms that can occur after brain injury, such as headaches. Depending on the severity of the injury, people can have seizures. People can have visual changes and balance problems. So there are all of these kinds of symptoms, but I would divide them into basically these four categories: general physical symptoms, behavioral symptoms, mood symptoms, and cognitive symptoms.
And some of these symptoms can sort of mask and sort of exacerbate other problems. If, for example, if you're having sleep disturbances, which seems to be a fairly common side effect after a injury.
Right. Right.
I'd assume that the sleep disturbance itself is also causing cognitive and physical issues in and of itself.
Absolutely right. I mean, sleep is actually really, really critical, and you know, we spend a third of our lives sleeping. For good reason. So we're understanding more and more how sleep is just extremely critical for the normal functioning of our bodies. And after traumatic brain injury, again, it could be due to multiple reasons, but one cause is that because of the injury itself, if you're impacting certain parts of the brain, especially in the back of the brain, in the brainstem, well, that can actually cause sleep disorders. And so once you do develop a sleep disorder after brain injury, you're absolutely right. It can affect your mood. It can affect your cognition. It can affect a lot of things, maybe make you more prone to headaches. All kinds of things can occur because of sleep disturbances.
Now, in each of these symptoms of a TBI in the various four areas, you kind of describe a lot of the therapies. And I assume that's just to give family members a sense of what the recognized therapies are, what are likely to be the, you know, the sort of setbacks and outcomes that can come from the various therapies. Was that the point?
Yeah, that was certainly one of the points. And the other point was just so that loved ones and, you know, family members can understand that there are certain things that they can do, too, in terms of how do they deal with certain situations. So just to give you an example, if after the brain injury your loved one is much more irritable, let's say, and more agitated, well, sort of the normal or typical reaction might be to respond that way, be irritable yourself. But I think understanding the basis of all of this, understanding that this is related to the brain injury, is important. And then it's also important then consequently to have empathy and to not actually attend to that behavior. So that's something that's used by therapists. That's a technique used by therapists. But even family members can learn some of these techniques. And so not to attend to the bad behavior, because the bad behavior tends to get worse if you do that.
Yeah.
And it's better to distract and to have, you know, and have some structure in the day and those kinds of things to help minimize those symptoms.
I'm wondering if you run into this occasionally because of this changing viewpoint of how serious a concussion or moderate or severe brain injury is, that there's sort of a sense that, come on, get over it, from family members after 6 months, a year.
Right.
Do you run into that in the course of your practice, where it's just we don't understand how profoundly affected the person is because at times they may seem close to back to normal?
Right. That's absolutely right. Yeah, I do see that a lot. And that's one of the reasons actually for this book is to help people understand that, that, you know, that your loved one may look normal. They may seem normal, but there are profound changes that can occur in the brain because of brain injury at a chemical level, at a structural level, at a dynamic level. And there are consequences to all of these things. We have the sense that we control our brain. We have a sense that we are able to control what we do and how we feel and how we think, and that may be the case, but it is true that the brain is the hardware for all of that. And if you have damage to the brain, your ability to do those things is going to be impaired. And it's not obvious. That's why it's really a silent epidemic, because it's not like a person is paralyzed on one side, their arm is paralyzed, or they're in a wheelchair. I mean, these are things that are not obvious. These are things that are going inside the head. They're going inside the brain. And so that is something that family members are oftentimes can be frustrated. They may say, well, you know, what? Why is he not, you know, what's going on? Is he doing this on purpose? Is this person, you know, what's going on and why are they not recovering as they think that they should? Or they may say that, well, the person looks, I mean, he looks fine. He's completely normal, but yet, you know, he's having all these issues. And I think sometimes, you know, we don't make that connection necessarily between the brain injury and these behavioral symptoms.
The book is titled The Traumatized Brain. Dr. Sandeep Vaishnavi, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Sandeep Vaishnavi is a neuropsychiatrist at the Tisch Brain Tumor Center at Duke Medicine, where he's also a clinical associate in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. He is a co-author, along with Vani Rao from Johns Hopkins University in the Brain Injury Clinic there, of the book The Traumatized Brain. It's published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.